Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, my name is Christian Axbo Nielsen. I am Associate Professor of History and Human Security at Aarhus University in Denmark. Welcome to the New Books Network. My guest today is Sinisha Malešević, who is the Chair of the Sociology Department at University College Dublin. Sinisha's main research interests include the study of war and violence, ethnicity, nation-states and nationalism, empires, ideology, sociological theory, and comparative historical sociology. Today, we will be discussing Sinisha's new book, Why Humans Fight, The Social Dynamics of Close-Range Violence, which will be published very soon by Cambridge University Press. Sinisha, hello and welcome to the program.
Thanks very much, Christian, for inviting me.
It's my pleasure. Sinisha, you've published really prolifically on the sociology of violence and nationalism, two topics which you, of course, also link in this book. So some might look at the title of this book and wonder, what's new? With this in mind, in the acknowledgments at the beginning of your book, you tell the reader why you chose to write this particular book. Please share your reasoning with us.
Yeah. So I mean, you can say there are two main reasons. One is the kind of research-related reason linked very much to the work that I've been doing so far. And the other one is perhaps more personal. And so the research-related one is, I mean, I've published so far two books that are focused exclusively on sociology of violence and war. Both of these books are very much kind of macro-focused. The first book, The Sociology of War and Violence, which was published in 2010, was an attempt to kind of map this whole area of sociology of war, which was quite kind of developed between the two world wars, but then suddenly has disappeared as a field of study. I mean, there were individual scholars, obviously, who studied war, like Charles Steele or Michael Mann and a few others, but there was no really a defined area of sociology of war. So that book, the intention behind that first book was kind of to map the area to see, you know, how sociology can use its own research tools to tell us a little bit more about this field. And since then, I think sociology of war has developed. Now, over the last decade or so, we have a number of books, many journal articles kind of from that particular angle of research. Then my second book in this series is also very macro-oriented. That's the Rise of Organized Brutality, Historical Sociology of Violence. And here I was trying to kind of connect different areas of research across disciplines, again, using sociological tools, looking at genocide, looking at terrorism, looking at revolutions, looking at wars, and see what's common to all of these different forms of organized violence. And my focus was very kind of macro in that sense, kind of looking historically at the transformation of organized violence over long periods of time, again, trying to use sociological tools. So this book is different in a sense because it's more focused on the micro and meso level, if you like. So what I wanted to do is really to see how interpersonal context of violence operates, how people and why people fight, why they kill each other in different social contexts, not necessarily, but you know, war is obviously important, revolutions and all these other conflicts, but also, you know, in the context of crime, gang violence, homicides and things like that. I wanted to see what's common. Is there anything here that sociologists could, study as a common sociological project, if you like. So that's the focus shifts more in that micro direction, meso direction, but there is also the framing in it. There is a link, I think, between this book and the previous two books. They are very much linked. So that's the kind of professional research-oriented focus, but there's obviously personal reason behind that. As somebody who kind of grew up and lived in Yugoslav Federation and has experienced the collapse of the state, I really wanted to also explain to myself, perhaps more than to anybody else, you know, why people that I knew in my own hometown have changed dramatically over, you know, kind of fairly short period of time. People that were kind of nice, pleasant neighbors overnight became kind of very sympathetic to the right-wing nationalism and kind of were supportive of, or you know, at least they were tolerating violence that took place in the city where I was born, Banja Luka. Although I've studied in Zagreb during the war, so it was a very unusual experience for me to kind of see, particularly in the early stages of the war, how these things were happening on the ground in the interpersonal context. And I could see, and I had friends obviously in Banja Luka and in Zagreb, and it was very unusual for me to see how people transform and how they behave in these situations. So there is that kind of personal element, I would say, attached to this book that is perhaps less visible in my other books.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think a lot of the research that we do is, you know, there's obviously issues of objectivity and subjectivity when precisely when we deal with those questions that we are asking also for personal reasons. But it can also, as I think your book illustrates, give an extra impetus and motivation for performing that research. And I just want to mention that, you know, you make me think also of how when I'm with my students, one of the things I ask to them or ask of them is how they would react if they witnessed an act of fighting, of brutality on a bus in Denmark. You know, under what circumstances would they intervene? What considerations go into that and such. Now, this gets us to the next point, which is that in an earlier book, which I also quote often to my students, you wrote that there is a human obsession with violence, and you contrast the extraordinary degree of public and scholarly interest that we have in historical figures such as Hitler and Stalin with, for example, the much lesser interest in paragons of nonviolence such as Gandhi or Mandela. You also note the popular depictions of violence in television and cinema, and here, mea culpa, I, as a Scandinavian, I binge Scandinavian noir and all kinds of crime series. So what, in your opinion, explains this obsession that we have with acts of violence and fighting in particular?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that I deal with, as you mentioned, in the Sociology of War and Violence, but also in a few other publications and articles. And it is, I mean, it is very unusual when you look at violence, because in some respects, most kind of moral codes, religious traditions, philosophical traditions oppose violence. They condemn violence. The violence is seen as the kind of ultimate evil, sin, whatever a particular teaching would say. But then on the other hand, there is this really kind of interest, obsession, fascination with violent experience. And that's very visible in our popular culture. You know, we do all watch crime shows and, you know, particularly those involving homicides, and we read novels you know, people play video games and things. So television, cinema, our popular culture is very much saturated with imagery of violence. But much of that obviously is not a realistic violence. It's a depiction of violence. I think one of the reasons why are we kind of focused so much on violence is precisely because it doesn't happen so often. It's not something that most people see in their everyday life. Even people who are violent are not violent most of the time. You know, violence is often, as Randall Collins shows in his wonderful book on violence microsociological theory, you know, human beings are not very good at violence. More ordinary human beings are not very competent at violence. You need to learn how to be violent. You need to be trained. You need to be skilled at violence, and that's not easy for most human beings. So in that sense, there is that fascination comes from precisely from that kind of lack of encountering violence on an everyday basis. It is something that is you could say in part it's a taboo as well. It is something that we are as human beings are not comfortable with when we encounter, you know, if we are attacked in somewhere on the street, it is a scary experience for most human beings, even for those who are kind of, you know, police officers and people in the military, people who are trained, they encounter with violence is not easy. It never comes easy. It's a kind of, it generates a lot of emotional reactions, and it's something that we deal with. It leaves some traumatic experiences. So precisely because of that reason, we are fascinated with it. So in a sense, it's not something that, you know, it's easy to watch it on TV because, you know, you feel safe and secure because it's somewhere away. It's at the distance. It doesn't affect you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course, which some scholars have noted about crime procedurals, there's also this kind of healing effect that most crime series, except I should mention the Scandinavian ones, tend to resolve the violence, right? I mean, in the end, the message is the bad guys get caught, the good guys win, and order is restored. The fascination never ceases to fascinate me, which I can see reflected in generations of students as well. Now, you tell your readers in the book that, and I quote, "descriptions of violence can never be taken at face value, but require contextual and historical decoding," end quote. How does one achieve such decoding without ending up with observations and conclusions that are just merely ad hoc or sui generis for each specific case?
Yeah. Okay. So I mean, I think we do obviously have, you know, enormous research done on different violent experiences throughout history. But, you know, some of it, especially the further we go in time, is not particularly reliable because obviously descriptions of violence do not necessarily match the actual violence. So I think the point that I was trying to make is that, you know, we need to kind of contextualize violence. And in every different historical periods, depictions of violence were influenced by obviously its own time and its own place. And, you know, in different religious traditions, violence had different role to play. And I mentioned in perhaps more in my second book on the rise of organized brutality, how a lot of these kind of early descriptions tend to exaggerate the number of people killed in different different battlefields, because the idea was obviously not to impart information on what actually took place, but the idea was to present particular ruler as being very strong, powerful, able to do these things, which, you know, so you have all these, as you know yourself as a historian, you know, hundreds of thousands of dead or, you know, millions, but in reality, that couldn't be possible. So in a sense, so these depictions of violence do not match reality. But even when they do, you know, it's obviously, you know, in a more contemporary context, when we have a very much reliable information from historians, from anthropologists, from many different disciplines, it is important to see how we can kind of make sense of different historical and contemporary experiences. So obviously, you know, in social sciences, in humanities, we can go all the way back to kind of this Windelband's distinction between the nomothetic and ideographic approaches. And, you know, sociology as a discipline has been always depicted as a nomothetic one, attempting to generalize. So that's what I try to do in some respects. But on the other hand, I think what history does, you know, which is an ideographic discipline, provides us with kind of nuance, and it's necessary. That's why I see myself as a historical sociologist, as somebody who's trying to bridge these two worlds in some respects, because obviously overgeneralization is not good either, because you end up with you know, kind of some maybe overly strong statements which don't really work well in many different historical and contemporary contexts. So I think my view is that we can do this. We can do something which would go beyond the kind of individual uniqueness of every case. And every case obviously is unique and is sui generis in some respects. But there are elements that we can build to make some generalizations, but they don't have to be kind of enormously ambitious generalizations, if you like.
Mm-hmm. As a lapsed political scientist myself, who became a historian, I have to say that I reading your work, I always am wishing that someone would have told me that the field of historical sociology existed at an earlier point in my career. But discovering it is better late than never. So you say in your book that you coin a term which I hadn't encountered before. This term is social pugnacity. Please explain how you define this term, how you arrived at it, and what original insight you believe it allows.
Yeah. So this is, I was looking for a concept when I was, even before I started writing, which would help me navigate this kind of interpersonal experience of violence, where I wanted to emphasize the kind of the social aspect of it. So I was familiar with the term pugnacity, which was used, I think, initially by William McDougall, a psychologist from late 19th, early 20th century British sociologist, but he used that in a kind of Darwinian, social Darwinian sense as an instinct. You know, he talked about instinct of pugnacity. But when you look back to the Latin term, terms like pugna, pugno, pugnatum, they stand for fighting, for battle, for a struggle, for dispute. And I thought we can use this term. You know, this is a much more neutral term than the way how McDougall is using it. But I wanted to emphasize social aspects. So that's why I said social pugnacity captures this kind of something that I want to argue, what I argue throughout the book. So I think this concept is useful because it can capture the relational change, kind of collective character of close-range fighting, something that I'm focused on. So what I want to say and what I try to do in the book is that fighting is not an individual attribute. It's not a product of biology or psychology, although all these elements do play a part, as I say, in different chapters. But it's a phenomenon generated by contextual interplay between variety of things, between the structural context, between, different agents involved in the experience of fighting. And I look at the wider, social organizations and ideological diffusion and many other things. So that's why I thought this term would be useful for me, because it does capture this experience in one way, which allows me to say something about this interpersonal character violence of the close-range violence.
Mm. Absolutely. I also thought of the term pugilism, which I must be etymologically related there. Much of the very brutal violence that you describe at the very outset of the book is violence that takes place outside of combat. And in introducing your book, you also noticed that you were looking at organized crime, gang violence, other manifestations of fighting. But even when we look at combat, there is a lot of violence, for example, mass torturing of or executions of prisoners after the battle has ended and conquest has actually been secured. Do you think that it is worth distinguishing that type of violence fundamentally from that violence which occurs during actual combat?
Yeah, I think that's a good point in a sense, because we do see different experiences, different behavior of human beings outside of the combat zone and in the combat. However, my focus was really looking for also some similarities, because even when you are in a combat zone, there is a difference between fighting that is fairly symmetrical when you have two sides which are more or less of equal strength, and the way how they behave and the way how, we can always think obviously about trench warfare, First World War. This is a never-ending type of a conflict, but it's also a conflict with its own rituals, with its own rules, not necessarily involving these things that I mentioned, kind of the torturing and execution, because often and a lot of kind of research in sociology of violence points in that direction, that you see more of these kind of torturing and executions of among the kind of non-symmetrical, asymmetrical groups. So in a sense, when one group is completely dominant, it's more likely to do this. And we see that kind of historically, obviously, in medieval societies, you know, we had lots of these obviously gruesome examples what was happening, but often it was a kind of, you know, aristocrats doing this to peasants, you know, torturing them, sending them a message, you cannot do this, you know, because you're trying to do something to live above your station, or you're demanding certain rights that don't belong to you. So the element of the status discrepancy is important in that context. And we see that also in many other contexts. You know, Fuji's work on Rwanda is interesting also, the kind of this symbolic character of this of abuse. And, you know, obviously in the Yugoslav wars, we saw a lot of this happening also, particularly in the part that you've done research on that. So, you know, kind of the role of paramilitaries and you know, the kind of the symbolic abuse that is associated with, you know, for example, male-on-male rape, you know, which was very, very, very prevalent, particularly in the Bosnian war, and a lot of research now is coming out of this, which has that element of humiliating the enemy, of kind of establishing these hierarchies, status hierarchies between the two sides. But it's not something that happens on the battlefield. So you're right in that sense. These are different experiences, but my focus has been largely more on kind of on interpersonal context of fighting and you know, and it, perhaps this is more symmetrical in a sense. So I didn't really study, although I do have that in the second part of the book, which is much more empirical, dealing with the interviews of the former combatants, where you do see experiences that they do mention experiences of torture that they've, not that they participated in, but that they've heard of or witnessed indirectly and things like that. So this was happening and is part of many, many, many kind of violent experiences. Obviously, gangs do that often in sometimes in a more systematic way, because this is an important element of bringing somebody into the gang or differentiating who belongs to which gang. And also if you do something which transgress the rules of the gang behavior, torture is a mechanism of sending a message. So obviously there are differences between the professional organizations that avoid these kinds of things, or if they do it, they do them hiddenly in, you know, for very instrumental reasons, and organizations which are less professional. So they rely more on torture. They rely more on kind of these kinds of things, because they don't have a complete organizational capacity. So they, you know, this is a different mechanism of control.
Right, right. I mean, I think one of the interesting aspects is of the book is the truly global reach of it. I didn't sit down and make a list, but you certainly have examples from many different continents. And of course, you also have a lot of reflections on the meanings of fighting in various cultures, from those that are, quote unquote, more aggressive to those in which quite clearly not condoned and is less acceptable. This was something that I was also reflecting on, Sinisha, recently when I went to a fantastic exhibit on the Vikings of the East that is currently in at my university in Aarhus in Denmark. And there were some quite subversive narratives there, I have to say, in a Danish national context, where the brutality or barbarism, if you will, of the Vikings at the time was compared unfavorably to the civilized nature of, for example, various Arabic dynasties in the Middle East at the time. And this was done, mind you, not by modern anthropologists, but by, you know, actually looking at the primary sources and what they, the Arabs of the time, how they reacted to, for example, the practice of human sacrifice among Vikings, etc.
I think that's a very good, sorry for interrupting, yeah, I think sure. That's a very good example. It's an excellent example because that shows us, in a sense, when you have a much better organizational capacity, as Arabs did at that time when compared to kind of Vikings, you are less inclined to rely on these mechanisms of torture or kind of, you know, something that we would call barbaric practices, because you have other mechanisms to do that. You can control people on a much more successful way than, you know, and when you don't, and that's the nature of medieval Europe, you have to, you know, hang them, you have to kind of torture them, you have to kind of cut their heads off and put them in front of the entrance to the town in order to send the message, because you have no other mechanisms to control large segments of population. So I think that's a very good example. Yeah.
Yes, I mean, and obviously from the perspective of almost any society, as you also point out in the book, if you can maintain that level of state or societal control without resorting to violence, then there's a lot of costs at all kinds of levels that you don't incur.
Yes.
One of the more fascinating sentences in your book, in my opinion, is when you write, and I'm going to read it out loud here, I quote, "Just as human sexuality cannot be reduced to procreation, but involves complex emotional and cognitive interactions, the same applies to social fighting," end quote. Now, Sinisha, I don't really have a question linked to this quote, but I did want to include it. And I don't know if you have any additional reflections that you might want to share on that point with the audience.
Yeah, I'm not an expert in sexuality. My wife actually is a sociologist of sexuality, so I have an opportunity to talk to her. I think sociology, sexuality and violence are both interesting topics in a sense, because they are something that have been integral to a human experience for thousands and thousands of years, but are also have been taboos in many societies, and even in our own society they're still taboo in a particular way. But they shape human experience and also social experience, and we started learning much more about human sexuality very late. From maybe late 19th century onwards, we societies know more about complexity of human social experience, and now we know that this is not something only about procreation. It is a very complex phenomena. It involves so many kind of complex emotional interactions. It's changeable. It is linked to obviously social mores. It also involves cognitive interactions. It involves power interactions. Many other things. So we've learned a lot about sexuality, but I think we haven't reached that level in the study of violence, in a sense, because we still, not we as researchers, but I think, general audience has certain misconceptions and stereotypes about violence. It's something that is fairly easy to do, and it always happens in the same way, and it's always instrumental. It is about kind of... it's integral to some instrumental ambitions of leaders or people who use violence for their own purposes, things like that. But now as we study violence more on macro and a micro level, we see it's a very complex thing. It's not about violence has its own kind of dynamics. It has its own autonomy. It generates completely different emotional experiences, cognitive experiences. We learn through the experience of violence, or at least people who have experienced violence, that that influences them not only traumatically, which obviously is something that has been studied, but also it shapes your understanding of the world. And there's so many things attached to violence. So I think particularly studying violence on this micro level, interpersonal level, we do the sheer complexity, we see the sheer complexity of that experience, and particularly that element of social pugnacity that I'm interested in tells me a great deal about how emotions develop, how emotions shape our interaction, and also how human beings in small groups can influence each other, and emotional dynamics transforms. This is what I analyze particularly in the second part of the book, the experience of killing and things like that. And that's something that is worth exploring much more. I think I just tried to do this now, but it's something I think it's worth exploring more and more.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Right, and I would also look forward to seeing you with or without your wife exploring the intersections of the topics of your research and hers, because there's a lot of questions that have been raised there, and at least I'm certainly no expert on that, but just out from based on what you say in the book, as well as the examples I'm familiar with from the former Yugoslavia and other conflicts, there's so many questions that one asks about the intersection of violence / fighting on the one hand and sexuality on the other hand. So I think that's what really made that sentence of yours jump out at me. Now, you know, Sinisha, that I've worked at the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, the ICTY, and one of the things that I heard from a lot of people who worked in the police in Bosnia, for example, before the war, were explanations such as they would say to me, well, Christian, before the war, everyone in Yugoslavia knew who the troublemakers were in my town or my village, and the authorities kept them under wraps. When they did something bad or when they got drunk and provoked or participated in acts of violence and fighting, then they would be punished and life would go on, and it would be clear that society did not condone such acts. Later, however, when Yugoslav society started to disintegrate, those very same authorities, this could be at the municipal or regional or republican levels, actually started enabling those pathological actors. So I was curious, what do you make of that explanation? Does that ring true to you? And what factors do you as a historical sociologist identify that cause social structures to shift from preventing violence to enabling it?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, and it's a huge question, really, to answer. I would say my experience from former Yugoslavia is very much along the lines with what you're saying, but also reading and kind of getting to know other experiences and other case studies. I think one element which is interesting is, you know, we can start from that thing that human, you know, what Randall Collins is arguing, that human beings are not particularly competent in violence. So in situations of collapse of the state or wars or, you know, kind of revolutions and things like that, you have to rely on people who have certain skills, violent skills. And as you know, Christian, you've done work on Arkan and other people, you know, they were very much integral to this violent period because they had these skills, you know, of kind of being violent, being essentially thugs, but kind of almost a professional thugs, because they were employed you've researched this much more extensively than I have.
Mercenaries of a sort.
Mercenaries, in a sense, yes. And it's interesting how, regardless whether they were working for communist system or they were working for Serbian kind of nationalist state, they had to rely on their skills. But because they had these violent skills, they could kill people. They could mobilize a certain number of soccer fans and things like that, and capture territories and things like which they did. So in a sense, it is very much true that these are people that everybody knew were troublemakers. They were the criminals, they were the thugs. But in times of a collapse, state authorities, or which were also collapsing, and in these parallel organizations emerging, were inclined to use these individuals, and that has happened across. This is not obviously unique to Yugoslav experience. It has been happening all over, and it's very likely that is also happening in war in Ukraine on both sides. These are the people who have been trained. They know, they have experience of fighting, but they are pathological individuals in many instances. So obviously it's very difficult to rein them in. Eventually, when you give them a power, you give them a authority, and then that's very difficult later on to manage them. And that we had these many experiences even in Sarajevo with Juka Prazina, all of these people, which were initially very important for fighting, for defending the city, but they were criminals, and obviously they had their own interests. So in that sense, it's not easy to balance that. But many, this is not unique to Yugoslav experience.
Absolutely, I mean, it's easier to essentially activate these forces than it is to find the off button, because often their nature, their motivation transcends the more narrowed structured interests of the state or parastate entities that are commissioning them, as it were. Now, this gets us to the empirical side of the book, and I'd like to ask you to just give us an overview. Obviously, other than my privileged self, the listeners will not have read the book yet at this point. So please tell us about some of the empirical case studies that you use in the book and why you chose to include them.
Okay, so maybe just to say a few things about the structure of the book. So the first part of the book is largely kind of theoretical in nature, trying to kind of tease out what we know from different disciplines, from biology, including neuroscience and variety of other disciplines, and psychology and economics and ideology, and whether any of these things, what we actually know, can explain the fighting, motivation for fighting. So what I do in each of these chapters, in the first six chapters, I look at the variety of this literature. The first chapter is focusing really on the physiology, if you like, in biology of violence. Are there any biological preconditions for us to be violent? And when human beings are violent, how biological explanations can deal with this. And in the second chapter, I deal with the kind of economic explanations, focusing more on self-interest and looking at kind of what the rational choice and kind of other instrumentalist explanations have to offer. Then in chapter three, I look a little bit at the kind of explanations that focus on the role of ideas and culture, kind of the so-called ideological fighting, whether this is really the main reason for fighting. Then I look at a little bit at the role, of course, of power in forcing people to fight against their will, which is obviously an important element in what states do and what criminal syndicates do and gangs and things like that. Then I also look a little bit at the kind of emotional attachment that people have to people that matter to them, family, friends, and these networks of microbonding, how we fight for others, when do we fight for others. And I would argue that's a very important element, perhaps more important than fighting for oneself. And then I also look at the experience of non-fighting, because that's also not something that is, you know, default position. It needs to be explained, you know, how non-fighting happens, you know, when people are more likely to not fight, and obviously that's also linked with the particular social organizations and things like that. So that's the first part of the book, which is mostly theoretical, not exclusively. As you mentioned already, I do look at lots of different examples, short examples. Every chapter ends with a comparison of two different cases in different parts of the world, and I wanted to be as global as possible, so I was looking at lots of different examples. The second part of the book is much more of a kind of relying on interviews that I've done with former combatants. So there are five chapters really here. Four of them are, you know, very empirical, using this material with interviews. So these are interviews done with former combatants from Croatian Army, from Bosnian Serb Army, from Provisional IRA. I've also analyzed letters from soldiers from the First and Second World and Spanish War, Second World War and Spanish Civil War, Indian soldiers who fought in the First World War in Europe, Wehrmacht soldiers and the letters that we have from them, and U.S. Spanish volunteers. So I look. I try to kind of combine all what we know from all these different research techniques, if you like, to see, you know, how they describe their own experiences of fighting, with the interviews that I've conducted myself with the former Bosnian Serb soldiers and Croatian soldiers. I was really focusing more on people who did have a experience of battlefield. So I've excluded everybody. I mean, I've interviewed many, many people, many more, but they're not really in this book because many soldiers weren't really involved with the combat, particularly on a long-term basis. So these are kind of the experiences that I explore, and I use a lot of these interviews from because they tell us a lot about the kind of social dynamics that develops in the battlefield during fighting, before the fighting, during fighting, and after fighting. Also the way how their emotions are developed and you know, kind of reflected, how they reflect on the experience of fighting, on the experience of seeing somebody dying that mattered to them, their comrades, and also their own sense of responsibility towards people back home, families and friends, which obviously is important in the first, you know, as an important motivation for them to stay on fighting regardless of what's happening. So all of these kind of different cases help me kind of understand how the social dynamics of close range fighting operates.
Yeah, and I think again, it's really impressive how you not only include these case studies but approach them from so many angles, where you really bring to bear the tool set that you have acquired from surveying the available literature in various fields. Would it be correct to state, Sinisha, that your own view, based on your review of the available research, is that human beings are, first of all, not inherently violent, and that they are often even averse to fighting, but that violence has become more widespread and exacerbated in terms of casualties and intended and unintended consequences because of modern state structures and technology?
Yes, that's in a way, broadly speaking, what I've been trying to argue in all these three books that I've written on violence. So obviously, you know, this whole issue starts with the debate of Hobbes versus Rousseau, and you know, Hobbesians arguing that human beings are inherently violent, and Rousseauians arguing we are not, you know, we are peaceful creatures. So I could say I lean more in direction of Rousseau, but not completely, and I say that very clearly. I think in the sociology of war and violence, I say they're both wrong because they're not sociologists. So they're both social contract theorists. They assume there was this kind of state of nature, which obviously we know now that there was no state of nature ever. So I think, you know, if you bring a little bit more sociology to these kind of all debates, you know, we can see that, you know, saying that human beings are not prone to violence. Is really more to more. It's not Rousseauian in a sense that we are inherently good. I wouldn't argue that. I'm more leaning in the direction of what Collins is arguing, that we are not very competent in violence. In a sense, that's you know, as creatures, we don't have horns or sharp teeth and strong jaws or anything. We are very as individuals. We cannot compare to lion or any kind of predatory animal. We could be easily overpowered, but obviously we rely on other human beings, and we've been doing that for thousands of years very successfully, and we've become so powerful. So our strength as human beings and our kind of capacity for violence stems very much from our ability to create social organizations, particularly the state. So that's what we've been doing historically. And this is, for me, the origins of large-scale violence have to be linked to development of these powerful social organizations. And obviously, as you mentioned rightly, technology. Technology is a part of that. Obviously, we couldn't build technologies without having social organizations, because they are always inventions. But if you don't have organizations to produce this on a massive scale, then inventions are not, they're not materialized, they're not realized. So that's what I try to do, in a sense, to emphasize, kind of this inherent weakness of us as a species for violence, and also we are not comfortable with violent experiences. As I said, even people who do this on a professional basis, and we do have a lot of research on police officers, particularly American police officers, on soldiers being fighting in many wars. Many of them are not really comfortable with this. Even though they do that on a regular basis, there is a breaking point, for almost every human being. So in that sense, what matters is really looking at social organizations that have increased their capacity over hundreds of years, over thousands of years. And that's what I do in some respects my 2017 book, The Rise of Organized Brutality. I try to show that, this increasing capacity for violence is linked with social development. It is linked with capacity of these big and powerful states.
Well, I think, there's a point in your book that I chuckled out loud, because you in a kind of humorous way dismiss what, and this is not your term, but what is kind of the almost comical inadequacy of the human body as a fighting instrument. Unless you said we're not sharks, we're not lions. And yet, the paradox which we are living with is that the human mind is supremely lethal, in the sense of having not only developed these state structures, which of course can do much good, but also can do much harm, as well as, of course, the technology that enables us to literally obliterate other species, as well as potentially ourselves from this planet, both inside and outside of armed conflict. And again, that's where I really like your work, because you do survey so many fields. So now I'm going to ask you a question with a little bit of an introduction that I can tell you, Sinisha, is a question that, although none of our colleagues has explicitly asked me to ask you this question, I'm sure that they all want to know the answer. So by way of introduction, when I took my comprehensive oral exams at Columbia University as a history PhD candidate, I remember afterwards my late doctoral advisor, Mark von Hagen, saying to me, "Christian, this is the last time in your professional life that you will ever be able to read so broadly. From now on, you will be struggling to keep up with the scholarly literature on increasingly narrow topics." You, Sinisha, have surveyed an enormous scope of scholarly literature from many different fields in your book. So please, what is your secret? How do you manage to keep abreast of developments in so many scholarly fields?
Yeah, maybe I do the opposite of what your supervisor said to you. No, I mean, for me, I was always a great reader. I loved reading, and for me, I continue to do that. I don't read necessarily only strategically. There is an element, obviously, when you have to write an article and you have certain deadlines, you focus more strategically on certain things that you need to master. But I kind of read almost every day, and I always read things which I find kind of interesting, puzzling, even though they may not necessarily be related to what I'm actually working on. So in a sense, I think that's perhaps the way how you kind of connect all these different areas. Although I could say I have a few research areas that I do more research, more reading in general than others. I work on violence, I work on nationalism, and work on social theory. So sometimes I study violence, I have to read as much as possible from very different disciplines, because I have to learn, I have to, from other people, I have to learn from, what other disciplines have to say about this phenomenon. So I always feel like, it's not adequate for me, even though I'm a sociologist, trained sociologist, that's not enough for me. I have to read, everything more or less what's been done on violence in order to say something, but still kind of maintaining my own sociological kind of angle on all of it. So when I read something which is from paleontology or anthropology on violence, I try to bring sociological glasses to it and try to see, okay, let's see what, does this make sense, in how these people behaved in that time, because obviously as human beings there are so many things that are common to us regardless of when we live. So you're right, it's not easy to kind of survey this enormous literature, and this literature is there's more and more of it. But the problem is a lot of it is becoming more and more specialized. So I think either you can go in being extremely specialized in a particular area, or you have to try to be kind of to balance this, to be kind of more of a generalist, but generalist within particular field. So the field of violence is enormous field anyway, but this is still narrow enough to say, okay, this, I have certain expertise in this area, but I don't know many other fields, that are out there in sociology or anthropology or any other areas. So I try to keep abreast, but it's not easy to do that. It is demanding. It's getting worse in that respect. There's more and more books that I want to read. I have so many books and articles, on my desk that I'm just trying to, use the summer to read more of it. And it's, but I think we do have to ask ourselves these big questions. Yeah.
I was going to say that I sometimes have a sneaking suspicion that all the time that I've spent in my life watching television series and films that are about violence or fighting, that's the time that you were actually reading scholarly literature about violence or fighting.
No, I watch films as well.
Okay, good. That makes me feel a little bit better, but then makes the question even more acute. Well... Now, having paid you this compliment, I'm going to turn around and ask a question that some might perceive as being a little bit of a backhanded compliment, but it certainly isn't intended to be so. So, I've noticed, I've read, I think I can say most of your books, and I've noticed that in them, including in this one, you often systematically and in a very keen and precise and also enjoyable way, you tackle each of these large thematic or disciplinary approaches to the topic at hand. And you then incisively summarize them, and you point out the strengths and deficiencies of each of them. And having kind of dissected, or if we want to use the language of violence, drawn and quartered them, you then move on to the next big topic in the next chapter. Now, some readers might, however, feel that this leaves them wanting for the ultimate answer, namely, what is Sinisha Milosevic's preferred methodology for studying why humans fight? What would you say to such a reader asking such an obnoxious question?
Yeah, it's not an obnoxious question. It's a good question. I mean, basically, what I try to do, if we focus on these three books on violence, but you're right, I do that in many other books as well, on nationalism and ethnic relations and things like that. I mean, the idea for me here is really to see, again, what we know, what are the available approaches, and I'm trying to kind of, it's a sort of a starting position for me. It's also a learning experience for me. So when I was reading and adjusting all these different literature, literatures, I was trying to kind of summarize them to say, these are the key issues here, these are the key points, these are the key answers that they provide. But I find them, you know, problematic for these and these reasons. This is what's valuable, what's good, what's worth preserving, what's worth building on. So that's usually the kind of the, you know, first or second step that I do. But I do kind of try to kind of develop a theoretical angle, which is present in all of my, particularly last five books or so, where I focus on these three processes, which I find the most kind of important. They're not the only processes, but I find them useful for organizing, my own understanding of these phenomena. So I look at this, you know, kind of coercive organizational capacity, how it grows through time and importance of it. That's very visible in my 2017 book, where I'm very explicit about this. And then I look at the wars and revolutions and terrorism and genocide through this prism. Then I look at the role of ideological capacity and penetration through society. And I also look at the micro level, what I call the micro solidarity, the envelopment of micro solidarity. So these three processes are present in most of my books, particularly in the last five books, as I said. And that's a kind of theoretical, they are the main theoretical tools through which I organize this knowledge, through which I criticize alternative perspectives, and through which I try to explain, you know, the phenomena that I study. So this is not an ultimate answer. I don't provide an ultimate answer, but I do provide kind of an angle through which we can perhaps start understanding the phenomena that I study. So even in this book, I do this extensively. First half of the book is very much kind of engaging with what's out there, what we know, and I recognize the importance of many of these perspectives. But I then again say, okay, you know, economic reasons, biological reasons do matter, but they don't explain this phenomenon. But I say ideology does matter more. I say organizational power and coercive power matters more. And I say, this kind of micro bonds matter more. So then I work more and bring the kind of these tools that I've developed in previous books to explain this phenomenon here. But then I add also a few other things, the role of emotions and things like that. So in theoretical terms, there is a particular perspective that I've been developing now for a while, perhaps last 15 years or so. And it's cumulative in a sense. You could see how it links, you know, different books are linked very much, you know, the way how I explain nationalism in, let's say, Grounded Nationalism book, or in the 2013 book, Nation States and Nationalism, I use similar tools to explain violence, but obviously context is different and phenomena is different.
Sinisha, my last question for you today is, what major avenues of future research would you like to see pursued on this topic? And what major lessons would you like readers to draw from your book?
Okay, so obviously violence is an enormous topic that has been studied by so many different disciplines. But there is still not, I think, enough interaction between different disciplines. So we have the kind of psychology of violence, we do have sociology of violence, anthropology of violence, and so on and so forth. But, you know, that's in some ways is what I try to do, to go across these different disciplines. And I think I would like to see more of this kind of research, that, you know, you have a research team, so people, one is psychologist, one is historian, one is anthropologist, sociologist, and they work together to produce this kind of research on a specific topic of violence that is cross-disciplinary in a genuine sense, that people can contribute to using the knowledge and different research tools, because this is the same phenomenon. It's just that we are studying from different perspectives. There is also that element of kind of research which is either overly macro-based or overly micro-based, and I think we need more kind of interaction between these two. That's is not easy, because people who do macro type of research on violence tend to be historians, historical sociologists, people who have, you know, kind of long-term vision and knowledge of different historical periods and historical epochs, while people who study micro sociology of violence tend to be mostly psychologists, micro sociologists, who are kind of looking at the specifics, you know, minute details of interpersonal violence. And but I think it's necessary to do this kind of work. I mean, I don't think one person can do this. I mean, I try to do that, but obviously I don't have all these skills, and having research teams doing these kind of work or studies would be much more productive, would generate much more for us, you know, to know more about violence. And there are obviously this specific context of violence, specific experiences of violence, particularly organized violence. So we do have, let's say, lots of research on theories of and kind of experiences of revolutions. We have that on genocides. We have that on terrorism. We have that on wars in general. But again, not as much interaction between these different fields. And I think that's also an area which will be good to do this, to bring people who are experts in revolutions and people who are experts in genocide and war and terrorism, and see what they have to say, you know, how can they make links, because there are obviously links. We do know that people who take part in genocides and revolutionaries and soldiers, you know, have some similar experiences. So I think that's worth exploring. Also, differences that they show are worth exploring. So these are just kind of some very general, vague visions of how this field could develop further across disciplines.
Well, that certainly sounds like a lot of potential research that's waiting to be done there. And I think anyone who reads your book is not only going to learn a lot about this, but I think also feel inspired to, first of all, go and read much of the literature that you have marshaled and identified, and hopefully also to go and conduct relevant research that will help answer some of these questions you've indicated. Sinisha, thank you for a very interesting and also insightful interview. Today we've been discussing Sinisha Maleshevich's new book, Why Humans Fight: The Social Dynamics of Close-Range Violence, which will be published in early August 2022 by Cambridge University Press. Thank you so much, Sinisha.
Thank you very much, Christian, for organizing this event and for your very insightful questions.
Thank you, and thank you to the listeners. This has been another episode of the New Books Network. Take care and read lots of good books. Goodbye.